Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, one of the themes so far this year has been IPOs. There's been a lot of them with significant companies.
Yeah, IPOs are popular. They've always been popular. I mean, everybody knows what they are. What's interesting about IPOs when it comes to ETFs is that most ETFs are based on these indexes from MSCI and FTSE and S&P. And people don't maybe realize that it takes a couple years for an IPO to get big enough and pass the tests and screens of these indexes. So most people do not own new IPOs in their ETFs. Most people could be happy about that. However, there's a group of ETFs. I call them catch and release. They pick up new IPOs when they first come out, and they release in between 2 and 4 years. So this is trying to catch them in that early stage. And if you look at the performance, especially the one that's about 15 years old, it's great. It's kind of one of the more underrated areas, in my opinion, because most people don't have exposure. It's adding unique exposure. The performance is good. And so we've written about it a little bit, and Carolina Wilson from Bloomberg News has been covering it a lot lately. And, you know, a lot of IPOs flame out, and they give the rest a bad name, but there's a couple that are so good that they really cancel out a lot of those. And that's, I think the story we want to delve into today.
Also joining us is your boss, Gina Martin Adams at Bloomberg Intelligence.
Dun, yeah. Dun, dun.
I got to be on my best behavior today. No, I'm excited because Gina is the equity strategist mastermind of Bloomberg Intelligence. She leads all the research of our team, which is now equity strategy, ETFs, and ESG. We're kind of like everything that's not stocks and bonds. And so Gina leads that up, and I'm working for her on handling the ETF side of it.
This time on Trillions, IPO season. Carolina, Gina, welcome to Trillions.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So how significant is the number of IPOs we've seen so far year to date compared to a couple of the past years?
It's higher than it has been recently, but not as high as other spikes so far this cycle, and nowhere near the big IPO boom that we had in the 1990s. So it depends on your perspective. April was the biggest month for IPO issuance, both in terms of deals and value, since 2012. What happened in 2012? Facebook IPO'd. The other big spike was very early in the cycle when GM came back on the market. So it's been a big year relative to the last several, but not as big as other years in this cycle. April was notable, but the IPO market has slowed a lot since April as well. So we've got a little bit of a drag here into the summer.
One of the things that's been sort of interesting, though, has been this type of company that's been coming public, because they've been private a much longer period of time. And I'm, you know, first and foremost in that camp is Uber and Lyft, right? How has that impacted sort of what we're watching during this sort of IPO moment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that there has to be a certain degree of desperation for capital to come into the equity market anymore. And the way that I think about this is, as a company, your access to capital is in many ways much, much better than ever before in history. Liquidity is ample. There's cash everywhere. Private equity companies have a ton of funding. VC crowdfunding is huge. So to come to the equity market, you have to come already in a very, very high stature, because it's extremely expensive relative to the other sources of funding. And so what we're finding is the companies that are coming to market are generally much, much bigger. They've established some degree of track record. I think the other thing that is probably underappreciated is the investor is extremely discerning, especially relative to 20 years ago, when anybody who came to market was like, yay, it's a new stock. We want it. Today, nobody wants stocks. Stocks are the redheaded stepchild in the asset class universe. Especially nobody wants U.S. stocks, even though they've outperformed and they've driven tremendous gains over this cycle. There's just not a lot of demand for shares. And so companies have to come to the market ready to face that. They have to be ready to push their story to an investor that is highly skeptical relative to the investor of the past. And they have to come bigger because their access to funding is very different than it has been in the past. I think it's just a different kind of IPO. Companies aren't even following on with equity issuance, right? It's just nobody wants to use equity markets when debt is so very, very cheap and private capital is so cheap.
What do you got to say to that?
No, it's interesting. This is what I love going to Gina for big picture, or if I have a theory, she sometimes will give me perspective or just straight out like stomp on it.
We have very healthy arguments in our team.
I feel like that was a pretty great rain cloud to put over public markets.
Yeah, I'll only counter that with, I think if you look at equity flows and you net them all out, obviously a lot out of active equity mutual funds, but a lot of money has been going into sort of like general Vanguard S&P funds. So if you've been doing that, you have been doing great. I think the equity markets tend to be something that people are still a little shattered by from 2008 still. But let's shift to the ETF a little bit. So we just went over the story here with the IPO season getting going, and they get a lot of press. I think that's why we tend to think there's a lot of them. Carolina, just talk about your foray into looking at IPO ETFs and what you learned.
Sure. So there are two that come to mind as sort of the biggest in the space. And back to your point that indexes will like drag their feet when it comes to including new companies in there. I mean, just a stat, Gina mentioned Facebook. It took 2 years before Facebook was added to the S&P 500.
That's crazy.
Isn't that nuts? So these ETFs do provide a sort of pocket to invest in this market before, like Eric was saying, you can get it in any other sort of normal indexed product. So the two big funds in the space, you have the Renaissance IPO ETF. It's known by its ticker IPO. I would say this is like the purer IPO ETF of the two, and I'll explain why, but it'll typically include new companies at scheduled quarterly reviews. It can buy shares of the newly listed companies with at least $100 million in market cap, though, as soon as 5 days after the IPO. So it bought Uber about 7 trading days after its IPO back in May. And it right now holds Uber, obviously, Lyft, Zoom, Pinterest, Beyond Meat. Its biggest holding currently is Spotify. And then you have the bigger, but I would say less obvious IPO ETF. It's about $1 billion in AUM. It's the First Trust U.S. Equity Opportunities ETF. And it doesn't sound like an IPO ETF, right? And if you look at the holdings, it doesn't look like an IPO ETF.
What's its ticker?
FPX.
Yeah, it does not sound like an
IPO. It's rough. So if you look at the holdings of this,
there's only one IPO ticker, right?
They should have used something better, and I would say call it new or something, but because they add spinoffs, I don't know. There's probably a better ticker out there, but First Trust is a pretty, like, I don't know. They're not a crazy ticker kind of company.
So FPX, what do you see?
So you'll see PayPal, Verizon, Hershey. Can anyone guess when Hershey IPO'd?
1972.
Gina?
No idea.
1927.
Oh,
oh my
way
gosh. No, you just inverted the numbers.
Oh, my
that's
God.
That was pretty cool.
That might be before the Dow Jones Index.
Isn't that nuts?
Around the same time.
That's but to your point, because this ETF will include spinoffs or firms that are acquired by a company that went public within the preceding 4 years. So like Hershey bought Amplify Snack Brands in the beginning of 2018.
Oh, so even if it gobbles up something.
It's a new IPO.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
right,
it'll be included in there. So some people will say,
you're getting exposure.
Right. Are you diluting the IPO effect? First Trust will say, but maybe we're providing more diversification or cushion because IPOs are very volatile. So that's sort of the landscape.
So how have they performed?
So IPO, the Renaissance ETF is up close to 41% year to date. FPX is up 29%. So I do see the dilution there with that IPO effect we were talking about. And the S&P is up close to 20%. So IPO is almost double the returns of the S&P this year.
Let me jump in here on the performance issue, because FPX, if you go back to when it was incepted in 2006, there aren't many ETFs that have like 15-year track record, basically. It's up 345%. The S&P is up 208%, and so that's through 2008 and Great Financial Crisis. That's 137% outperformance. If this were an active mutual fund, this would be the cover of Forbes, the cover of Fortune. It's got $1 billion, which isn't bad, but I'm kind of shocked that it just works. And you looked at Facebook. You talked about that it didn't go into the indexes until the second year. Facebook was up 113% in its first 2 years. And if you look at of that performance, 10% of the contribution to that return was Facebook alone. Facebook, and if you look at the ones that didn't do well, they didn't do well, but they didn't do as bad as Facebook did good. So there was a couple just total studs that totally offset the duds. And I think that's the secret sauce here.
What do you attribute the outperformance to?
The studs are bigger than the duds are bad.
Mm.
You just need a couple giant home runs, and it seems to make up for some of the crappier ones.
So, Carolyn, when you look at IPO, what do you see there?
So IPO is up over 40% year to date. And the FPX ETF is up 29%, so a little less, but still more than the S&P, which is up about 20%. And a note on when these ETFs will get rid of those new IPOs, right? Because they all obviously sort of switch out their holdings. So IPO, I believe, after 2 years, it'll kick out those companies because that's around the time that these companies start getting integrated into new indexes. And I think FPX will hold them up to 4 years.
Yeah. I used to call them catching them during the toddler years. But as Gina mentioned, they're not toddlers when they hit the market anymore. They're mm-hmm. they're like almost grown adults. But yeah. you are
they're
getting
like
them.
Teenagers.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are. But you are getting them with some growth spurts. And Gina, I'd like to point this to you because when I was writing my note on IPO ETFs, I don't know, a year ago or so, I kind of brought it to you like, am I missing anything here? So I ask you, just as a personal investor, is there anything that would give you pause before buying something like FPX or IPO? Like, what could go wrong here?
Well, I think you can go through phases, right? So typically, if you're thinking about the long-term cycle, the peaks of IPO issuance tend to be right at the end of the cycle. They tend to be the 2007s of the world, the 2000s, the 1999, 2000s of the world. So
why is that?
Part of it is confidence. Companies are pretty good at assessing when they're going to get the best value out of it, right? If you're issuing stock at peak valuations, you're probably going to get a lot of capital relative to if you're issuing stock at very low valuations, you're not getting a lot out of it, right? So they're pretty good at timing as markets go higher. Also, it's just a business cycle thing. It's confidence. At the peak of the business cycle, activity is very, very robust. Everybody's excited about the prospects for equities. Generally, confidence is very, very high. So you're feeling great about the likely outlook. The market reception is typically better. You know, people generally during big IPO booms, you get better returns to those IPOs in the immediate after issuance period than earlier in the cycle where there's much more skepticism. So I think you can get caught in a trap of market timing to some degree with IPOs, though the historical evidence is irrefutable over the long term. You're getting the companies generally earlier in their life cycle and your returns are going to be better. I mean, it's very similar to the capitalization effect. Normally, if you're buying smaller and mid-cap stocks, you're going to get better longer-term returns. You're taking a lot more risk, but your return should be better as well. And I think that that gets reflected in these sort of style ETFs that we're discussing.
I was chatting with Kathleen Smith, who runs the IPO ETF, and it's interesting. We were saying how investing in IPOs is like very emotional, right? It's about the emotion. And so she talks to financial advisors who are trying to get their clients to asset allocate, and they'll call them and be like, get me shares of Uber. And they're like, no, we don't want to do that. But she argues this is where an ETF can step in and it can be like, here, this is a safer way to ride this IPO wave without loading up on shares of Uber.
Well, and you're also diversified across IPOs. So to Eric's earlier point about the studs and the duds, your median return for IPOs this year isn't great, but you have big, big companies with much stronger returns like Beyond Meat that are overwhelming some of the dogs that have come out so far this year. And that produces much stronger returns when you have a basket. I think your average investor would really have a hard time accessing that basket. And they might pick emotionally the Uber because they're familiar with it and miss out on opportunities or a broader array of options.
With the IPO ETF, how does she pick which one she buys and which one she doesn't buy? Does she pass on stuff?
She has a rules-based index. It's a rules-based index, so IPO will follow that. But for example, I thought it was interesting that FPX bought Lyft, but it was waiting until the next quarterly review to add Uber because they claim that, well, this is the first, you know, ride-sharing stock to market, so we're going to buy that, but we're going to wait on Uber. But there are a lot of analysts that point out a lot of differences between Lyft and Uber. So I know that Kathy sort of said has had some bones to pick with that. You know, you shouldn't be able to choose that specifically if it's a rules-based index and it just gets added in.
That is exactly why passive really isn't passive. I mean, even the S&P's got a committee. I mean, it's all the wiring in these things is all human. It's very active. And you could see the returns could really deviate based on that little decision difference between IPO and FPX. That's why I should have some job security going forward.
So what is something that she's passed on so far this year based on her rules?
I don't think anything. I mean, seeing the holdings, I think IPO holds all of
the
major...
If it's gone public so far this year,
It depends a lot on the size. So I think there have been a lot of biotech IPOs to market, but they've been smaller. So they're going to pass on that.
$100 million threshold. Yes. Got it.
Now, one thing we do see is the first day of the IPO, there's like all this fanfare. A lot of times there's a little drop after. There's some, and that's when the press really gets angry. Can you talk about the fact that there is a little delay in the when the ETF picks it up? It doesn't pick it up on the day it's born, so to speak. It waits a couple days by design. Can you go over that?
So I think FPX can actually pick it up after the first trading day. Normally they will not. Like I said, it'll be about five trading days for IPO to pick it up. And I think they're waiting for a certain amount. I think they want the volatility to diffuse
of the gaming.
A bit. Right.
Yeah. All the people who bought it just to sell it on day one. And Gina, how much of that is going on? How much of these bankers, these you know Wall Street bankers who are sort of have their hands in this IPO and they're just waiting to like dump it to the dumb money, so to speak? And what's that process like?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a ton of visibility into that. I think there's a whole trading operations built around IPOs that I don't have a great degree of visibility into. But there definitely is a whole cottage industry in trading IPOs. I mean, even individual retail investors can get really into IPOs trying to figure out how to time the purchase and then dump of these companies, anticipating that there will be extraordinary optimism. And I think that's frankly a legacy of the 90s experience, which is interesting because here we are, I don't even want to mention how many decades later from the 90s. Nonetheless, in the 90s, the experience was very precisely IPOs are always greeted very, very kindly by the market. It's a much different climate now, and it's a lot harder to trade these entities. Nonetheless, there are still whole trading shops set up around and operations set up around gaming the IPO system.
So one thing that has changed since the 90s is that there's this other way to go public now, which is a direct listing, which we just saw with Slack, and a year ago we saw with Spotify, which even if it's a direct listing, I guess a ticker with the IPO can actually still do it, right? Because it's just when you go public. But Gina, when you look at direct listings and think about IPOs, what's changing with this new sort of flavor?
Yeah, I think some of it's the marketing machine is very different. Technology has obviously forced this to happen. Back in ancient times, when I was starting in my career, you only IPO'd through an investment bank because that was the machine by which your shares ultimately got to the final consumer. That machine is very different now. You don't necessarily need an investment bank to market your company, to market your shares, to describe the value to the average broker. And that's a function of technology and communication more than anything. It's also a function of cost. Again, we talked earlier, when money is cheap and easy, it changes the game. And it's changed the game from, you know, having to pay extraordinary fees to a big investment bank to help you list to much, much lower fees over time and now direct listing. So it's just it's comprehensively a very different climate than I think many of us, you know, who have grown up in this business know of the IPO industry.
And should we expect to see more of this new machine?
I think so. I think overall, you're seeing this across the board. The one thing that could really change the game is interest rates start to rise again, right? I mean, there's one big macro trend that has dominated everything for the last 30 years, and that is a persistent decline in the cost of funds, on the debt side especially. And that has really changed access to capital, liquidity. The other thing that obviously has contributed to this is technology, the development of technology, the sort of driving communication process, enabling access to individuals that didn't have access before. I mean, the development of the ETF industry fits right into this theme, right? So those two things, should they shift, could really shift the game, but it's difficult to make a case for either of those two fundamentals changing anytime soon.
I also want to talk about besides IPO ETFs, which I'd consider niche, another niche type of ETF is theme ETFs, like the Global X Social Media ETF, SOCL. I remember back when Facebook was IPOing, it dominated the news for like 6 months. And that's when I really learned.
Because it went down?
Just that it was coming out. Facebook, to me, probably was the biggest IPO that I can remember having to cover as an ETF analyst. And everybody wanted to know which ETFs and when. And I remember at the time, FPX was one on the table. But believe it or not, the first one to add it was SOCL, which was the social media ETF. Here's the point, is that that's good, right? If you have a social media ETF and you don't have Facebook fast, you're like, what am I doing here, right? So I think the niche ETFs are aggressive and a little unconventional on purpose, and that's probably good. But you should know that. Like, some people just may not want something so aggressive. So it's not just IPO ETFs. It's thematic ETFs in the industry it's tracking that you could end up with new IPOs very quickly because they tend to have a more liberal wiring than the more traditional sector ETFs.
So one related question to these IPO ETFs. I would think that they would appeal to retail investors, but who's actually using them? Is this do you see, when you guys look at the numbers, are institutions in them in a big way, or do you see that there's a lot of retail there?
So the big institutional clients, they're the pros, right? And I asked Kathleen, I mean, if it's the job of these big active managers or bigger institutional clients to do the research and pick these single stock names, will they really use your ETF? And something interesting that she said, actually, in June, the IPO ETF has listed options now, which will attract the more sort of tactical clients. I mean, sure, the liquidity there is less, but, you know, now a hedge fund could take the other side of this trade if they wanted to.
It looks like FPX, right? That's the bigger one with $1 billion. About half of it is definitely retail because only 50% shows up in the 13Fs. You do have some like Raymond James, so some advisor networks own it. It's kind of about what I thought. I don't really see any big institutional money like pensions or endowments. They're probably buying IPOs on their own with a manager, either external or internal. But I think for advisors or retail, it's good. And again, you know, the beauty of ETFs is if you're lazy. I mean, this thing does all the hard work. You don't have to watch the news. You don't have to care. It's just going to suck up the new IPOs, hold them, try to squeeze out that juice, and then let them go. And you just don't have to really lift a finger. But there are people who track it, like Gina was talking about, even day traders. The whole point, if you're researching this stuff, you would never use the ETF. And I think the institutional market would probably fall in that camp in this case. Gina, would you rather, as this is all presented, do you think you would do better just tracking them all in the FPX style or trying to game it and pick it through an active stock picker? Like, how do you think that would work out?
For me, and I think the average investor, I fall in the lazy category, right? So for me, the diversification benefit of the basket is far and away much, much more appealing and attractive than trying to do the legwork to find that individual, you know, nugget of gold in a whole pile of sand, like, because I just don't know that every individual has that level of expertise. Yes, if you're an institutional analyst dedicated to that industry, you presumably should be able to pick the winner. But every one of us has their own area of specialization. Mine is macro. I have no idea what these companies do for the most part. I'm not going to spend an inordinate amount of my time on the weekend trying to figure out which one of these companies is going to be the big winner. Instead, I've definitely fallen into the lazy category. I'd much rather have the basket, especially given the proven returns. I also just don't have the risk tolerance, frankly, to take on single name exposure at such a minute level. It's just not within my DNA.
I want to bring this up because if you are gaming and timing, remember the Uber IPO? I think you even wrote an article saying, hey, your ETF's going to own it. Isn't that not good? I went back and I Googled like Facebook IPO. It echoed what people were saying about Uber. And Facebook turned out to be the stud of all studs. So
yeah.
I do think there's this like pylon, like negativity. And if you are active, that emotion could really influence your decision. And I could see not have stucking with Facebook after the IPO, whereas the index is dumb. It just does it because it's like a robot.
Yep. I'm old enough to remember the Google IPO. Not that I want to age myself here, but I can remember being on the desk and all of the skepticism around where Google was going to go. Right? It was like, what
time,
is this company? It's a search engine. They'll never
make money.
There's
like 20 of those things.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, why would you ever want to touch this?
It's funny. Now there's like, and people rightly so trash it, is CNBC in particular. They'll put these tweets out saying, if you had bought Google at the IPO and with $10,000, you would have $8 million or something. Mm-hmm. And they kind of rub it in your face. And then on the flip side, they trash new IPOs. So I'm just like, there's a disconnect here. If you're going to trash every new IPO and jump on the bandwagon of hating, then why would you go back and pick the winner and do this sort of like rubbing your nose in it that you didn't buy it? I think the media has like real mixed signals on that, in my opinion.
Yeah. It's also legacy. I mean, it's the pendulum just swung from one end of the spectrum to the other. It was every IPO, I'm telling you, in the late 1990s, every IPO that came to market was God's gift to the investment universe,
Pets.
Right? It was like, yeah, gotta have it. You can't have enough. And then when all of those, many of those, not all of those, but when many of those failed and ultimately just, you know, weren't even companies anymore, it really changed the investor psychology toward IPOs. And we've been fighting that battle of skepticism ever since.
We talked about IPOs. We talked about how they wait longer. It's more expensive. This taps into what you hear more about, which less companies going public. Can you talk about IPOs in the public market versus the growing private market? And
yeah,
how should a retail investor deal with being shut out of the private side? And how much is that going to grow in proportion to public going forward?
It's a really good question. I don't know that I have a very clear crystal ball on how much private versus public will grow. But I do think that there are a couple of things to note. The first is the companies themselves are incentivized to stay private longer because of their access to capital and liquidity. So that would have to shift. A couple of things are happening that could create a shift. One is if economic growth starts to accelerate much more rapidly and sentiment starts to improve toward the investability of public assets, it could make issuing your stock on public markets much cheaper, and that would improve that, you know, incentive. The second thing that I think is really important to watch is tax policy. We've been in an environment for many, many years where companies have been incentivized to utilize debt because they can write off the interest expense on that debt. They can't do that with equity. Well, as a component of 2017 tax reform, companies are now limited with respect to the amount of interest expense they can write off, and they'll be even more limited starting in 2022. If you can make a case for in 2022, they're more limited from utilizing debt markets, which, you know, any company can access debt markets. You don't have to be a publicly issued company in the S&P 500 to get access to corporate capital, right? So that's part of the story, is it's not just private, it's also public debt markets that companies can issue in. And that's the bigger story, frankly, because if suddenly you start to see the tax incentive eliminated and rates go much, much higher, companies will be forced to consider other ways of funding themselves, equity being the other choice. But back to your original question, which I veered off of, not intentionally. In terms of the private markets, I don't see that changing a whole lot, because a lot of what's happening in the private markets is technology-based. It's being able to fund through crowd, right? It's being able to fund in alternative ways that are much cheaper. And it's at its core a function of the fact that we have access to this via technology, right? As an individual retail investor, I can go online and search, I'd like to get into a crowdfunding organization. Now, that didn't exist 10 years ago. It's a totally different landscape.
I think that also sort of calls into question whether, bringing it back to the ETF side, these strategies can be used as a proxy for the health of the IPO market, right? So we look at the Budweiser deal that didn't get done. It would have been, I think, the biggest IPO this year. You know, do people chicken out because they can say the health of the IPO market isn't great right now? Or could we now look at these strategies and be like, well, look at this ETF that's up 40%. You know, can you really hide behind that excuse anymore?
And just to one more thing is that there are some ETFs that use private equity in the name, mm-hmm. to give you the feeling that you're buying into private. You cannot use an ETF for private. Just to let you know, these ETFs tend to look at small and micro caps that have private equity like traits.
Yeah.
It's, in my opinion, that's kind of faulty advertising. But
what about VC? Are there VC ETFs yet?
No, they just call them private equity. Now, there is a private equity that tracks public stocks that invest in private equity, but even that's very diluted. You're really stretching there. So when we write about private equity, we pretty much say, like, you know, just forget about it. The ETF, just there's some places the ETF just can't go.
Yep.
Last thought, Gina, it's that part of the year, mid-year moment, where there's evals. So if you want to talk about Eric later, we can totally do that. Carolina, Gina, thanks very much for joining us on Trillions. Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm @JoelWeberShow. He's @EricBalchunas. You can find Gina Martin Adams at Gina Martin Adams and Carolina Wilson at Caro E. Wilson. Trillions is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.